I'm Justice Bill Meyer, and I'll be your presiding justice this afternoon. On my right is Justice Lynn Dolfino, and on my left is Justice Sue Walker, and we'll be your panel for this afternoon. So if the clerk will call the case, we'll get started. Proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. In this case, the trial court abused its discretion in the following respects. First of all, the court lacked jurisdiction to enter the order that it entered. Secondly, the record doesn't support the findings that it made in the sanctions order against the attorney, and the order fails to adequately explain why there was a basis for sanctions against the attorney in this case. And then fourthly, Chapter 9 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code simply doesn't apply to this case and should not have been a basis for the order. And I'd like to address each of those points sort of in order.
Well, Appley concede that either 9 or 10 would apply and they want 10?
Well,
is that their position?
My understanding of their briefing is that they say 9 does apply, but then Chapter 9 also says that if Chapter 10 applies, Chapter 9 doesn't apply. But our position is Chapter 9 would not apply in any event because this is not a tort case. This is a breach of contract case.
And so if 10 applies, then it doesn't matter that 9 doesn't apply, does it? Or does it?
Yes, exactly. It would not matter.
Okay. I think you might want to talk about something that does matter.
Well, I think the first thing I'd like to talk about is the jurisdictional issue. This motion for sanctions was a pre-judgment motion that was filed before there was a final judgment in the case. The final judgment was actually the dismissal order, which was signed on May 24th of 2011. That order specifically says it dismissed the entire case. After that dismissal order, within that 30-day window for Rule 329B, there was not a motion for a new trial filed. There was not a motion filed to change or modify or correct that judgment. Nothing was filed. There was no post-judgment motion that would have extended the plenary jurisdiction of the court, which extended until June 23rd of 2011. Now, on June 23rd, the appellees have raised an order that the trial court signed called an order retaining the case, but I don't think a trial court has the authority to extend its own jurisdiction past the period for plenary jurisdiction.
Was the order dismissing? It was simply an order granting your client's motion to dismiss, correct?
What it said was the case is dismissed.
Right.
And there was no counterclaim. So if the plaintiff's case has been non-suited and there's no counterclaim for affirmative relief by the defendant, then at that point it's a final judgment.
But the motion for sanctions was pending, correct?
But that's a collateral motion. That's not that's not the same as a counterclaim for affirmative relief.
Why not?
Well,
isn't there case law that says that a motion for sanctions is a claim for affirmative relief and that a party can't basically non-suit someone's motion for sanctions by filing a non-suit?
Well, we're not contending that we non-suited the motion for sanctions. What we said is that the motion for sanctions is collateral to the main suit, and the court can still act on that motion within its plenary jurisdiction. But once the jurisdiction's gone, it's gone. And it's like a motion for a new trial. You can grant the motion for a new trial until plenary jurisdiction is over, and then it's gone. It's too late. And in this case, it was too late. Even if there had been a motion for a new trial filed, which there wasn't, but even if there had been, that would have only extended the plenary jurisdiction to September 6th of 2011. Well, this sanctions hearing wasn't even over by then. The order wasn't signed until 2012. So clearly the court's plenary jurisdiction went away Whether you say June or whether you say September, it went away. And after we briefed the case and in preparation for oral argument, I came across this court's decision in a case called N. Ray Julie Brown that was decided in 2007. Justice Walker, you were on that panel, but I believe Justice Gardner wrote the opinion. And essentially, the court did exactly what we're advocating in this case. Set out the guidelines, the time frames, and simply said the sanction order happened after the plenary jurisdiction ended. And consequently, it's just a void order. And the order should simply be vacated.
Is there any distinction in the fact that it was an order of dismissal versus a judgment? Is there any distinction to be drawn in those two scenarios?
A dismissal order is a final judgment if that's all that's pending. And in this case, that's all that was pending. The plaintiffs had a cause of action for breach of contract. The defendants had no counterclaims. They did have this sanctions motion, but the courts, I think, have uniformly held that is a collateral matter. It's not the same as filing a counterclaim based upon a cause of action. In fact, I believe it was the Marty case that we cited. It says specifically it's not a separate cause of action. It's just a collateral motion, like any other prejudgment motion. Consequently, I'll supplement my argument with a citation to that case for the benefit of the court. But basically, our position on that is that the court simply lost jurisdiction and the order is void and should be vacated. But even if there was jurisdiction, is there any evidence to support the sanction finding? I don't see any. First of all, there's kind of three bases, as I read the order, that there was some kind of an improper purpose on Mr. Walter's behalf, the attorney, that the legal theories were groundless and that there was no factual basis. Well, let me start in that order. First of all, improper purpose. Well, the improper purpose supposedly is harassment of the defendant to do something she didn't want to do. Although my experience has been defendants who get sued always think they're being harassed. I don't think that an attorney filing a cause of action on behalf of a client can be said to be harassing the other party. There certainly was not any evidence at all of any intent on Mr. Walter's part to do anything other than zealously represent his client, which I think is what attorneys are supposed to do. And keeping in mind that the burden of proof is on the appellees, where in the record is there any indicate? In fact, it's just the opposite. The presumption is that the pleading was filed in good faith. And where is there any evidence that overcomes that presumption of good faith at the time the pleading was filed, which is the focus? With regard to the legal theories, here again, at the hearing, if you go through the entire record, there was no discussion of what the law was. It was kind of interesting. The case was tried as though it was a trial on the merits, but it really wasn't because the case had already been dismissed. But the legal authorities weren't discussed at all. The appellees brought no legal authority at all that said what you're asking for is legally not recoverable or is legally not viable. In their brief, have they given the court any indication of why they think this breach of contract action is not viable? What the facts come down to, as I understand it in reading the record, is there's a contractual divorce decree, where the husband, Mr. Jennings, is going to pay money to the wife, and the wife is going to make car payments. And he makes all of his payments, and she doesn't make her payments. And I think if you look at Appendix 7, 8, and 9 in our brief, those are documents from the record that clearly show she's at least four payments behind, plus hundreds of dollars of late fees that hadn't been paid. Clearly, she had breached the agreement. And so Is it possible to say that Mr. Jennings complies with the contract and Mrs. Jennings doesn't comply with the contract, and somehow or another there is no legal remedy for that? He just has to grin and bear it, according to the appellees.
Wasn't she supposed to hold him harmless?
That's what the language of the decree says. And certainly
there's a procedure for pursuing a whole harmless agreement.
My understanding of that would be it's a breach of contract claim. It's a failure to comply with that agreement.
Well, there's a hold harmless agreement, and where did y'all ever attempt to enforce the hold harmless agreement?
I think that's the basis.
You abrogated the contract.
I think that was the basis of the suit.
That would be a
there
suit
was also a claim for there was also a claim for. Damage to credit, which would be an attendant consequence as the result of her not making payments on a debt that Mr. Jennings was the debtor on.
I thought y'all sought to abrogate the contract, void the contract, and the contract's what had the hold harmless agreement in it.
Well, there was alternative pleadings there. One was there was a rescission argument, but then also there was just a plain breach of contract argument as well.
Well, neither of those is pursuing your hold harmless agreement, the suit on the contract.
I think that, well, I would interpret it as being a suit on the contract, is to enforce the contract, or if the court finds that the contract.
What are you doing to enforce the contract? You said yourself that it was, you were arguing rescission and breach on their part. Well, that's not a suit to enforce a provision of the contract.
Well, it would be a suit for breach of the contract, failure to comply with a condition, a requirement, an obligation of the contract.
Okay, so that's not pursuing the whole harmless provision of the contract. You're suing, that would be suing to enforce the contract, not to consider it breached and rescinded.
Well, I think it may be... It may be the same thing in a way, because enforcement of the whole harmless essentially is a sense to recover damages for failure to comply with the contract.
Yeah.
Well, it's based in the contract in any event, and I think the law is that. Material breach on the part of one party discharges the other party from further compliance with the contract. So the question is, if she's not making the payments she's obligated to pay, is it incumbent upon Mr. Jennings to continue to comply with the contract that she's already breached? And I think the Supreme Court and this court has said no, that there's grounds there to say he doesn't have to comply with making any additional payments when she's not making any additional payments. But in any event, I think there is a remedy there, and it may not have been artfully drawn. It may have been, you can disagree with the legal basis for it, but I think that's far different than saying that somehow or another it's sanctionable. Every case that comes before this court, one side or the other is wrong on the law, but that doesn't mean the losing party should be sanctioned every time. In this case, it's very clear that the attorney put extensive research into this case, and there certainly is a factual basis. There again, if you look at the appendix of the brief, there was a swearing match as far as who who breached what and who did what when, but there's no basis for saying that there was never any basis for asking relief from the court, and there was never any factual basis to support that request for relief. The factual basis, in fact, is the payments simply were not being made. Mr. Jennings, according to the appellees, was just supposed to grin and bear it and sit back and let his credit go down the tubes without complaint.
All he did was try to get out from under the obligation to pay alimony.
And apparently, the wife wanted to get out from under her obligation to make the car payments and believed that she could simply walk away from that obligation without the court giving her permission to do so or without any legal basis for doing so. She was receiving $600 a month and couldn't make a $500 a month car payment. I think she chose not to make the payment. And here again, you can argue the law and you can argue the facts on it, but I think it would be hard to say that it's groundless and there's simply no remedy available to Mr. Jennings in that situation.
Mr. Sweat, in fact, there was never a determination made as to whether the causes of action pled in the original petition were, in fact, a subject that could have been granted relief by the court, because the court never got around to trying any of the causes of action asserted in the petition, but merely tried the sanction motion.
Well, that's true. And this was a sanction motion, not a trial on the merits, and so presumably there's a lot of things the court could have heard or would have heard in a different context, but a dismissal on a non-suit I think has no effect at all, and you can't read anything into that.
Well,
the other
I read the record, and I saw that the court acknowledged the dismissal of the lawsuit at the start of the proceedings whenever there was a first witness called on the motion on the hearing on the sanctions. Then trial court acknowledged that the case had been dismissed. Is it your contention that even with that acknowledgement that there was still a proper way for the court to go forward on the hearing for the sanctions at all?
I don't think there – well, no. If this had happened within the 30-day plenary jurisdiction, a court can always change its judgment.
I understand, but that didn't happen there.
But I follow what the court's saying, and I think that if the judge has acknowledged the case is dismissed, and when you get to the 31st day, you just stop. The jurisdiction is simply expired.
In fairness, the court did continue with the statement that that the court was viewing the motion for sanctions as a seeking of affirmative relief, because that was what trial court said on the record.
And I think that's correct, Your Honor. And I believe that the trial court may have, I mean, I think that was an error on the judge's part, but the case law has kind of, it's not all that clear, and I certainly don't fault her for misreading that, but I do think, having researched it and looking at this court's decision in this Julie Brown case, the courts have simply chosen to treat it not as an affirmative relief like a counterclaim, but instead to treat it as a collateral motion that just has to be dealt with expeditiously, because otherwise this case would go on forever and people keep filing motions for sanctions and the case would never end.
Have you looked at the Supreme Court case, Unifund, CCR Partners versus Villa or Villa?
I have looked at that, Your Honor. I can't quote it to you off the top of my head, but...
That was the same thing, right? Case was dismissed and the judge heard the motion for sanctions afterwards, because as long as the sanction motion was pending, it couldn't be a final judgment dismissing.
I'll look at it. I would have to say I don't recall that I read it that way. That may have been a situation where where the case was decided during an extended. I think they treated something as a motion for new trial and extended the court's plenary jurisdiction.
Any other questions? Thank you, sir. Clerk, please add 5 minutes to Mr. Teller's time, Brian.
Ready? Okay. May it please the court. My name is Donald Teller, and I'm here to represent, myself in this situation and also my client, Ms. Sonia Jennings. I'd like to briefly respond and really go where Justice Dauphineau was mentioning right off the bat. to, I think the question of the plenary power argument is squarely answered by the case that you cited, the Unifund case, and also the case that kind of came before that, Kreitz v. Collins. Both those are very procedurally alike to this case, to where there's a plaintiff that filed a petition, a defendant that filed an answer, and then also filed a motion for sanctions. At some point, the case was non-suited. However, in both Kreitz and Unifund, the court held that that because those non-suits did not unequivocally dismiss all the claims and all the parties, that it wasn't something that started the plenary power ticking. So in essence, in looking at that case in Kreitz, the court, after the non-suit was granted, and the non-suit in Kreitz actually looks very much like the non-suit in this case. There's a few wording differences, but in essence the same. None of the them deal with the sanctions at all. But the court in Kreitz actually started and rendered its sanctions order 36 days after the non-suit order. In Unifund, the order came 9 months after the non-suit order. In both those cases, they held that that it was not a, because they did not deal with the sanctions, it did not dismiss the case. That also has been applied to a family law case in N. Ray Anderson. It's not a published case, but it's a case out of the First District in Houston. And that would be, because I guess Kreitz was a medical malpractice and Unifund was a debtor-creditor. And then N. Ray Anderson applied it to a family law situation. So clearly, by the Supreme Court cases of 2009, which I guess would have come after the Julie Brown case cited by Mr. Sweat, the plenary power was certainly in play. Turning to other points of error that he raised, the third and fourth points of error, which I guess is really whether this complies with Chapter 10 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, because I like Justice Dofano, if it falls fine under Chapter 10, Chapter 9 kind of becomes irrelevant. I agree with that. If you look at the sanctions order in this case, and you compare it with the sanctions order that was actually listed out in our brief in Doro versus Cantwell, which is a case that comes out of this court. It arose out of the 322nd District Court. But if you compare the language between those two orders, they're very, very similar. I mean, it kind of looks like the judge in this case probably modeled her order after the that opinion. I mean, there's no way to know that, but they look remarkably similar. The only real difference is the opinion in this case has a little more meat to it. It specifies some of these specific things that she did. Like, for example, she specifically stated that the improper purpose was trying to harass my client into giving up her contractual alimony claim. And it indicated that the petition alleged a right to equitable relief when there wasn't that was not a valid claim it warranted by existing law. And the opinion in Doro versus Cantwell wasn't as specific as the one in this case. But suffice it to say that if the opinion in Doro found that the order was sufficient to meet the requirements of Chapter 10, you would suppose that an even more specific order in this case would certainly meet the requirements of Doro. So under their third, and that really falls squarely on their third point of error. Their fourth point of error, I guess it goes into the specific claims under Chapter 10. First of all, I guess the improper purpose, whether the claim was warranted under existing law, and then the claim as to whether the facts had evidentiary support. With regards to the, well, And actually, before I should get into that, there's one fact about this case that's probably one of the most important, if not the most important fact, that makes the Chapter 10 analysis more important. I asked Mr. Jennings when he was on the stand if he had apparently had sent a voice to my client about the dispute over the car payments on this car. And I said, did you make this statement on her voicemail? And I read it to him verbatim. And it, you know, Sonia, if you would, do not drive the car. Leave it at your apartment until I can figure out how I can make up the payments that are past due. Keep the keys, because I have insurance on it from that standpoint, and I'll deal with Capital One. I asked him, did you make that statement on her voicemail? And he says, yeah. So, that's in May, I believe May of 2010. Mr. Walter shows up shortly thereafter. And in June of 2010, he then sends a letter to either Ms. Jennings or the divorce attorney for Ms. Jennings, but it gets to Ms. Jennings. And that's where, and he doesn't ask for her to keep making the car payments. They never said that. He immediately goes in and says, I want you to forgive all this contractual alimony.
Mr. Teller, was that the letter that your client said she didn't remember on the record?
She did initially say that she did not remember it on the record. That's true. I mean, it's a fairly involved case. But I cannot recall off the top of my head as to whether it came through her or through her attorney. I think she did state that, but then, and the letter is actually in the record. It's Movement's Exhibit Number 1. There's no denial that it was sent. But what the letter was, you know, a demand for to give up on the contractual alimony. And then the petition followed a month later, again, using all kinds of alleged legal theories to try to get rid of the contractual alimony claim. There never was any type of, you know, claim, demand, or anything for her to keep making the car payments. And so I think that, you know, if you look at what the purpose of this suit is, you know, was considering all the evidence, all the letters, all the claims from the time Mr. Walter entered this suit concerned giving up the contractual alimony, I don't think it's a stretch to say that the purpose of this suit was to get her to give up the contractual alimony.
And what legal theory, what legal authority is there for the proposition that when you have a divorce based upon contractual agreements and the divorce itself states that the agreements between the parties are picked up and made a part of the judgment by virtue of their contractual agreements, and in a contract law situation, what authority is there to say that you cannot file a suit on claiming a breach of a contract part of the divorce judgment, and that is by itself improper if what you're attempting to do is offset other portions of the same contract?
Well,
the same contract that's included in the judgment. I don't want to sound as though I'm not giving credence to the fact that the judgment itself is what brings forward these obligations that the parties are attempting to litigate in the form of a contract claim, and in your part, on the part of a totally improper attempt at arriving at an offset on the contractual alimony.
Let me address that point with you. One point I would point you to an opinion that you wrote in within the last year, in Re WLW, and what that opinion would talk to about is that where there were, in essence, this is a redo of the property division, and you can't do that under Texas Family Code 9.007. So I would, and that's really, if you're trying to.
Still waiting to see if that was a correct opinion, Mr. Teller. That's still being reviewed.
Okay, well, maybe that is, well, there are other cases that say that. And of course, the statute, 9.007, also states that, and I know you based your opinion on that. However, certainly the statute is there, and it's been there for I don't know how long, longer than I've been practicing, I assume. And really that's what it is. If you're trying to redo the car loan and you're trying to redo this contractual alimony that's part of the property division, it flies in the face of Texas Family Code 9.007, and that's not a valid claim. I had one other point. And I certainly think that that would show that. Let me back that up. I guess if you look at the petition that he filed, you know what it really seems to be is a attempting to combine or make a divorce decree just all kinds of contractual agreements. And all of them are related to each other. In this decree, there's nothing actually stated in the decree that makes the alimony dependent upon the Jeep payment. I mean, I know he said that he thought that that the two were related. She said that, no, the reason I got alimony is because, you know, I haven't been working and he spent a bunch of the retirement money. And certainly the phrasing of the decree does not make any type of relation between those two events. And if we, you know, tried to draw those inferences, you could draw inferences between any portions of the property agreement if you're allowed to do so, which is, I think, one of the reasons that 9.007 is there and says you can't do that. What they could have done is filed a motion to enforce the decree and tried to, you know, have the car sold, or if he had made the payments, then he could have, you know, sued her for the payments that he would have had to have made to keep his credit good. He certainly had that remedy available, but trying to undo part or all of this divorce decree and sue her for, I don't know, $60,000-$70,000 over, in his view, four car payments is just way out of line, in our opinion, and I believe that the court also found that. So that would be the improper purpose and not warranted by existing law. With regards to the allegations not having evidential support, probably the best example of that would be throughout their petition, they repeatedly claim that she repudiated her obligation or you know, refused to make the payments on the car. And if you read the record, it's just flat out not accurate. And certainly that information was available long before this petition was filed. And it is kind of fuzzy from the petition as to whether we're talking about before she turned the car back over to him after that voicemail, or whether we're talking after that, even though the petition was filed only a couple months after the car was turned over. So I would think it's probably from beforehand, but it is kind of vague in the petition. But if it is from beforehand, I mean, she says she was one payment behind. He says he was four payments behind. But neither of those is refusing to pay it, repudiating your obligation, or anything even remotely close to that. So just that factual allegation that's interwoven throughout that petition is just factually not true. And then if we're talking about it being from after the she turned the car back over, you know, that one to me even makes less sense because you have a situation where he says, I'll take care of Capital One, and I'll figure out how to make up the past due part, and then they turn around and sue her saying that she's repudiated her agreement. You can't do one thing and then go the other, and particularly since they never even asked her after that point to make the car payments. They just went straight into the contractual alimony. I think the facts it clearly again shows that that allegation just did not have factual support. And that's really the remarks, unless there's some questions that y'all have. That's really, I think I've covered the points I wanted to cover.
Thank you for your presentation, Mr. Great. Connor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr.
Sweat, you have rebuttal.
May it please the court. Here again, a lot of the rendition of the facts that you're hearing here is Sonia Jennings' rendition of what it was. If you look in the appendix to the brief, what in which Appendix 8 is basically David Jennings' rendition of what happened, and this was introduced into evidence as a summary of his testimony. He says, Sonia informed me, this is May 12th, Sonia informed me during a phone conversation the morning of May 11th that she had gotten another vehicle for herself and I needed to get the Jeep Compass. I asked Sonia to write a letter stating she was forcing the car back to me with the payments. She verbally refused to comply. She sent me an email on Tuesday, May 11th, refusing to write anything regarding this request. Below that, Terry Kenner from Al Clark State Farm Agency called me and said Sonia had dropped the insurance on the vehicle and wanted to know if I'd like to get coverage to protect myself. That sounds like a repudiation of the contract. And that's, now obviously that's David Jennings' side of the story. But it is a side of the story that Mr. Walter, as attorney for Mr. Jennings, I think you have to take your client's side of the story as opposed to the other side, which of course, as an attorney, you don't know what the other side is. There was no way that Mr. Walter could know what the testimony of the client was going to, of Sonia Jennings was going to be at the time he filed this petition. And that's what we focus on. What did he know, and when did he know it, and what was his intention? The facts of this case are in dispute, but it was very clear that Sonia Jennings had not been making the car payments, and based on these statements that she made to Mr. Jennings, she didn't intend to make any more. Her idea was, if I give you the car, I can walk away. That doesn't change the decree. That doesn't change her obligations. She could still have paid for the car. Even after it was repossessed, she could have paid for the car, because the decree says she's going to pay the debt. It doesn't say that she only pays the debt when she has the car. It says she's going to pay the debt. As I understand it today, she still didn't pay the debt. So the facts are in dispute. And when facts are in dispute, and I want to focus on, you have to focus on the mind of the lawyer, not on the mind of the client. I have no idea what was going through David Jennings' mind. The record doesn't make that clear, other than I think he was upset that he was being constantly harassed by collection people for payments that weren't being made pursuant to this agreement. I don't think that's hard to understand. He was concerned about his credit rate. I don't think that's hard to understand. I don't see any malice in any of this testimony. These are people that had a dispute. These are people that probably don't like each other very well. But that doesn't make it some kind of a vendetta, and it certainly was not a vendetta in this case. Mr. Walter researched the law and put a theory forward that he thought had a basis, a legal basis, and that he thought had a factual basis. There is a factual basis that Ms. Jennings was not complying with the agreement. There's no doubt about that. This is an agreement. Mr. Jennings' testimony also was that it was a tit for tat. You know, you take the car and you make the car payment of $582 a month, and I'll give you $600 a month that you can use to make the car payment. And basically, he didn't get the benefit of the bargain because apparently he's supposed to make the car payments and keep sending the $600. Now, I would find it hard to believe that a court couldn't do an offset, because essentially she's supposed to make a payment on behalf of him and he's supposed to make a payment to her. Why the court couldn't offset those two payments escapes me, and I don't think the appellees have given this court any legal basis to say that that's a far-fetched notion and or one that's groundless and has no legal basis. Here again, I hope that I've emphasized enough for the court that to emphasize on what's going through the mind of the lawyer, not necessarily the client. You know, the lawyer's not there when these phone conversations are happening and emails coming. You know, you don't always know what the true facts are until you get to trial, until you hear what the other side is. And that's the question here. Is there really any basis to say that Mr. Walter knew the facts were wrong, that he knew the law was wrong, and he went on anyway? And I just don't think that's there. It sounds to me, if you look at the petition, it looks like he read a lot of case law and came up with theories that he thought were supported by those. And for that reason, we just feel that there's not a basis factually for the imposition of sanctions in this case, and that the appropriate thing for the court to do would be either to vacate the order or to reverse and render the order that the sanctions are not justified.
Thank you, Mr. Swift. Thank you, Mr. Teller. Appreciate your submissions today. Your discussions have been helpful. And your case is submitted, and you're free to go, or you can stay to hear our next case, which